interesting experience, the waviness of order, the nervousness of participants. Actually, the 1 year we drove as far as Leningrad, St. Petersburg, on a one-off tour. I tried to change the itinerary from year to year. I start getting bored and say, well, there are so many other places that we have not visited or included in our tours. Well, that particular year, we drove through Sweden, put our cars on a ferry between the mainland Europe and Denmark, to Copenhagen, then another ferry to Sweden, drove up from ferry point as far as Stockholm, very interesting place that we did not visit. Went to Lund in southern Sweden, visited Uppsala, and then we took the cars on another ferry into Finland, and Finland we drove along Baltic into Leningrad. The border crossing from Finland into Leningrad had the biggest surprise to our participants. We had two nuns amongst the group. The car in front of us was a VW, boyish looking driver and his girlfriend. They took the car apart, took out the upholstery, they took out the tires. They were looking for something, maybe the VW, but you couldn't hide that person, third person in the way, so they must have been looking for drugs or anything like that. And then they reassembled the whole car, took the wheels off, put it back there, and drove up. Now the Russian border guards come to our car. The luggage had to be lined up next to the car, and we all had to stand by our luggage while they picked a particular one. The fellow said, "Open, haven't you been the luggage belonging to those Catholic nuns?" And I see him just essentially collapsing. And she fumbles and opens the suitcase. The fellow says, "Close. Never look." Close, and the rest of the pack up. Okay, nothing happened, but the non event became an event, needless to say.
You mentioned Energay, I guess, where it would be pronounced. That was a memorable place, as many others were. But I noticed somewhere in some of the Hist minutes, and I don't remember what context this is in, but it mentioned that you slept on Ostpol's mattress.
Yeah.
At one time, so I would assume that you spent the night there.
I did this during my sabbatical, where I was getting ready to write the directory. I was not there with my history group. That was during an off year, and I was a private guest of Gertrude Brauer at that time.
Is she still living?
Yes, she sent it. Every year she would send me a telegram for happy birthday.
Oh, okay.
And I had one at the 80s one as well. And I visited her several times on my own, and she has a standing invitation to come and stay with us, which she has not fulfilled as yet. But she's aging, but as cheerful and gracious as you remember.
I remember her well. Anything else you want to say about those tours? Let me see. I think I had another question up here. I talked about the favorite place. What about favorite lecturer? Did you have a favorite lecturer? Or did people react to one particular lecturer?
Well, again, it's Gregor Brown.
Okay. All right.
But now I was found at Liebig Museum and his workplace in Gießen rather attractive. A, because of a friend that I made who is a descendant of
Lewicki.
Lewicki. Yes.
Lewicki, yes, yes, right.
Yes. And I like Madame, name will come to me, who was a grandniece of Louis Pasteur.
She was the woman that came with the dog.
The dog draped around her
shoulders, looked like a fur piece. Yes.
As a gift, an English name, because she married an English.
I don't remember her name. I remember her, though. She was a real character.
Yeah.
She's sort
and
of
a vivacious lady.
Yeah, and she sort of attached herself to the group like a camp follower and went along with us.
She warned that happens with several other ones over the years. And say, you people know so much more than we do, believe me, about maybe join you for an element.
You're right. Well, I thought it was great. It added some spice to
Hempel.
Yeah, Adam Hempel, right.
Names, right. They come right to me eventually. And one thing that I may or may not have told you, in the early years, we also went to Arbois, where Pasteur had his summer estate. She being a relative or descendant of Louis Pasteur, she pointed out that Pasteur was raising grapes and was making his own wine. That winery was bought out as commercial. It belongs to a merchant in Mayer. She introduced us to Mayer, who took us into the wine cellar of Pasteur, claiming there were still bottles from that vintage in that year. And he threw a party for us. We went down in the cellar. He had a goodwill house connected with his vineyard. And the waiters were down with aprons and open because to be able to taste the wine that Louis Pasteur actually had. And a very sumptuous barbecue type of dinner with the wine that he was serving. I think by the time you were there, the novelty wore off when I was in. We enjoyed actually going down into the wine cellar.
Well, we went to the summer home, but not the wine cellar. Well, let's turn to Kekulé. I think that when we were traveling around Europe. The one lecture that we were late to, and this was the Westmorelands and the Pratts, was in Brussels. We got lost, and we didn't speak Flemish, and we couldn't find any of the natives that would speak English. But we finally got there, and it was the day of your lecture on Kekulé, and so I don't think you were too pleased that we missed maybe the first 15 minutes of it, but anyway your passion for Kekulé really came out in that lecture. It was an excellent lecture.
Serendipity.
Okay. How did you get interested?
That's exactly what I'm aiming to address part of it. From the first tour on, we had a regular stop in Ghent, or Ghent, as a Frenchman, in Ghent, Belgium, where the topic was Kekulé, since Kekulé accepted the professorship at a newly established state university in Belgium, in Ghent, and he was lecturing there in French. Ghent is also a home of Colonel Hills. It's P-I-L-L-S, but pronounced Hills. He was an elderly gentleman who wrote biographies or articles on Kekulé throughout his life. He was a professor of English. And he told us a particular story, and people always wanted to know more. What did they want to know? Well, was Kekulé drunk? But was he inebriated? When he was talking about his vision in front of a fireplace, which was told eventually, or written eventually, after, say, 1890 comes. In other words, did he see snakes in a fireplace, or rather than pink elephants? The answer that Professor Healy said, he does not know. Yes, Kekulé was drinking. He enjoyed beer, especially imported German beer. He himself talks about it, about his years in London, where fellow Germans happened to travel to bring him a supply of beer. He married the daughter of an English family who went to Belgium to become the director of a gas company, the equivalent. And the maiden name of his wife was Rory, and he said he would not have been tolerated in that family had he been drunken, been drinking to excess. That was his reason. He said he was not inebriated. That was his opinion, personal opinion. And he studied Hill study, became a biographer of Kekulé. And that really didn't satisfy anybody, because here is a man, curator of Kekulé artifacts left behind, who really does not know and or doesn't have an answer to a question that puzzled many, many people. Well, I was there several times. Every year I asked more questions and start looking into an answer, and never knew the answer. Well, I wrote an article in Chemistry in Britain dealing with our additional research on Kekulé, really trying to find out who Kekulé was and why. Was it truthful when he reported he saw snakes catching their own tail in a fireplace where he was dozing in front of? So what I did, I said I'm going to really look into it, but I need a help. Who can do the research, laborious, library research. Here comes the serendipity. That problem I carried in my mind for many years. I was at Southern Illinois University when the then department chairman, David Schmulbach, knocked on my office and says, "John, help me." Well, he wanted help for a student who came to his office and wanted to graduate at the end of the semester. She was lacking 2 credit hours. And the department chairman asked me, "Well, can you suggest a research topic for her so that she can take it on the special topics and earn 2 credits and she can graduate?" That was Susanna Rudowski. Well, I knew Susanna. She took my history course. I knew she was born in Czechoslovakia, a family where Germans, we would now put them in a category of Sudeten Germans, in an environment which was 100% Czech-speaking, they were a German-speaking one. My father was a physician. He became a physician in the German Wehrmacht and died during the war. Go ahead. Thank you. The mother was a Swiss French. Her family apparently was bilingual, German and French, not German and Czech. They were surrounded by Czech speaking one, but Susanna knows absolutely no Czech. I mean, as surprising as it is, she was actually born in Prague. The delivery wasn't right, but they lived in southern Bohemia, not very far where my dad was born, actually, but did not know. The only thing she remembers that somebody was in a waiting room seeing consultation with the father physician, and she would say, "The doctor will be here shortly," or something like that, while people were waiting, you know. That's the only thing she knew to say in Czech. But not surprising to me, to people who are not familiar with post-World War I situation, the German situation, would understand. But anyway, she needed 2 credits to graduate. And I said, "Here is a student who can do the work. She knows German and she knows French." And I sent her to a library to make a library search of an error. Not an error. To search for the dichotomy or what looked like an misrepresentation of a factual historical event. There was one article that secondary sources listed as being published in can you interrupt? I have to look up a paper in Annalen, volume 137. Some said it was published in 1866, and other secondary sources published, referred to the same paper in Annalen 137 as being published in 1865. these rather important secondary sources in many well-documented, well-regarded review articles. The authors gives us those two different dates of a paper published by Kepler. And I told us to Susanna which is a correct date, because people get information from secondary sources. If some is an error, that error will propagate by subsequent authors, never going to the original article. They will go to the accessible article, which those two sources were. Is one in error? Which one is it? And who put it there? Well, she researched it backwards, coming from the most recent reference to those, to that article, going to a previous one which she knew they referred to it in the footnotes or reference and citation, and kept on going back. And I remember exactly the day I had a visitor in my office. Door was closed. She knocks on the door, puts her head in scene. I have a visitor. She says, well, excuse me, but I must tell you something. I found it. Good luck, Wayne. What you did find, the source of error, was made by Kekulé himself. Kekulé, wrote in 18. I'm looking in my own chapter to be sure that I get the dates right. 18. Hold it. In a paper published in 1872, Kekulé published an article which is deviously ambiguous. I mean, it's surprising. You know, he introduced the error in a following introductory paragraph. Here I'm looking at the German version. I already reported in 1865 my views on the constitution of aromatic compounds. I published it for the first time in 1865. This whole thing has a footnote, double staff footnote. He refers to a publication, Volume 137, page 158. Now it says he published for the first time in 1865 his view. Yet the reference to it refers only to a volume, page, and no date. That article did not appear in 1865, it appeared in 1866. So any scholar who reads this would say 1865, when truth it was 1866. An ambiguous way how to handle a reference. It is the fact that he doesn't give the year in his footnote in this reference citation that makes it appear 1865. When Drews was 1866. Now the question came, unquestionably, he's the author of this ambiguous statement that misled two earnest historians to listing his contribution in the Annalen 160, volume 137. She got her two credits. We published an article, a note in the journal, and she graduated, but I left her who said her question. Why did Kepler write such a misleading reference? He was an experienced letter writer. He has published before, but he was the editor of his own journal. Why did he slip it in this ambiguous way? And I start planning the story behind the story. What may have prompted this careless or ambiguous way to cite an important article? That appeared, the reference to this paper appeared in another paper which was published in 1872, where he is publishing on the constitution of Aromatica Aleans. He published that Aromatic Aldehyde paper in a period that was right after the Franco-Prussian War. I said, did he publish this because of some emotional involvement with the Franco-Prussian War or not? People did not realize that Kekulé was a German. Most people had the belief that Kekulé, with his accent, a Greek, was French, knowing German as it was not unusual in that period. Chemistry was done at that time already. Has moved from Lavoisier from France into Germany. Well, all this became research points. We had to find first-hand references to any opinion that may have pervaded amongst the subsequent generation. And number one, some said that he became von Stradonitz. Well, if he was French, why did he take on the name of von Stradonitz? Well, that was an interesting story in its own right. So let me back up from this account of the ambiguous reference to the von Stradonitz one. Well, Stradonitz is a German name from a Bohemian town of Stradonice. The Kekules were minor gentry. They were Protestants and had to flee the country after the 30th War, where the Catholic won over the Protestants. The country at that time lost all its Protestant gentry after the 30 Years' War. Well, Kekulé's family fled to what is now Germany and eventually settled in Darmstadt, in Hessen, as country. So the Fon was added when Kekulé was in his later years and wanted the Kaiser to ennoble him for his contribution in chemistry, like Sir Gierko, who just died, for his contribution in the arts. He became Sir. The same thing was with Kekulé. He wanted to become member of the gentry in recognition of his contribution to aromatic chemistry, which was the birthplace of the famous German pharmaceuticals and Leister. The Kaiser had advisors. No way would he become a gentry. Then Kekulé, learning about his background, petition for the reinstatement of the font, because that body was minor gentry, several generations ago. That was permitted. Now, that Axemar, the French Axemar, was a self-imposed change of name done by the father of Kekulé. The father was a civil servant in the Hessian government during the occupation of Hesse by the French. The French Napoleon conquered La Rovan and imposed a French government. In order to maintain the pronunciation, he put an accent aigu on the second E. Because the French would pronounce it Kekul. So now with an accent, it was pronounced Kekulé, as always. The Czech, the derivation of the name, come from Bohemia after, where every letter is pronounced. There is no question how you pronounce a Czech name. His birth certificate, and we found a birth certificate, writing to a lot of archives and so on and so forth, show that he is registered under Kekulé with an accent mark, but the text of the birth certificate refers to him without the accent mark. Therefore, the father made a self-imposed change. It was not written by the father, it was written in the birth certificate of him. That's why the misunderstanding, you see so many spelling of his own name. So there's nothing French in Kekulé, except the fact that he was fluent in French and lectured in French, and when he assumed the position in Ghent, he became head of department, professor ordinarius, head of department, in newly state university, newly founded state university. And but as you know, Flemish was the language of the population, but French, the Valois, used the French language in French speaking part of Belgium, but Ghent is in the Flemish part of Belgium, where people spoke Flemish language, similar to Dutch. And so there was again an ambiguity. Now let's come back to that reference. He was misleading in this article, giving the impression that he conceived his thoughts already in 1865, when in fact he wrote this in 1866. The question is, why did he try to mislead the public? Well, the article which started in 1872, referring to this article here, was written after the the war between Prussia and French, Franco-Prussian War. The question was he afraid, referring to an 1866 article, because it was written in French? Possibility. In other words, the hysteria of warring nations makes you ashamed of being part of the opposition, so to speak. But it is correct that he published that article earlier than he actually did, obviously made an impact on the chemistry, because the same article, 1861, was rewritten and published in German also. Within 6 months, the German version appeared. But to have it in 1865 would give him precedence, or would give him priority over the German one. But he doesn't want to refer to it in subsequent articles. Keep also the fact that the basic article, the structure of benzene, was commemorated 25 years later in the famous Berlin City Hall lecture, where for the first time he's talking about dreams. There was no mention in those articles, there's no literature references to dreams until the famous celebrations.
This is 1890.
What did I say?
You said 25 years later.
In 1890. So again, the veracity of Kekulé became in question. The double meanings are in uncertainty, the ambiguity. It's not different from other references. Once you are set on a trail, I mean, is it characteristic of his writing, or is a lack of veracity subject of closer scrutiny? All this start playing into our minds, and a subject of research, and we were very, very mindful of going to the original source, because we were so uncertain, we found it so unreliable looking in the secondary sources. I think I may have mentioned, if not, I'll mention it again, a lesson that I was taught by my preceptor, that's Melvin Newman, who said, all research starts in a library and ends in a library. So we did not believe anything unless we found the original source in a library, or a first-hand account by somebody who witnessed something. Because of this, we were challenged, and putting Kekulé under a microscope, and found ambiguity and not necessarily untrue statement but I'm paid by a fellow who used his position to his advantage. That's a picture that people talking about hallucinating, they're talking about the psychology of dreams, of the veracity of creative dreaming. That's a personal interpretation which everybody is entitled to, but in our opinion it is an incorrect interpretation. We also publish on all those erroneous interpretations by people who did not even know how to spell Kekule or could not identify his position or his whereabouts. But people wrote analyses of them, and they will tell you that that's possible. There is such a thing as creative dreaming, where people who study dreams in sleep clinics defined sleep as a rapid eye movement, which nobody knows whether he had it or didn't have. Was he dreaming? There's an ambiguity in translation, because the original translation of that speech is talking about träumerei. Well, träumerei is not a traum, which is a dream. Träumerei is dozing, perhaps. In dozing, you're not asleep. Yeah, you're fully conscious and just relaxing in front of the fireplace. So there is another ambiguity in talking about the physical state of his origin of his idea. Well, there is still another point to be made. Why did he do it? He was laying the foundation, in our opinion, for a priority, gaining priority. Because at the time of that 1890 speech in the Berlin City Hall, he was a man who was striving for recognition. People were now aware of a rather interesting fact. When he supposedly conceived that concept of the aromatic structure, he did not write a hexagon as we used it. He wrote a sausage formula.
Yeah.
Sausage with two arrows, meaning it's supposed to be closed.
Yeah.
Now, it is true that in the same year he wrote a hexagon in a proceeding of a Belgian Academy of Sciences. But when he wrote a hexagon, he put hydrogen atoms in a corner, not carbon. That's a very easy fact. He says Wasserstoff, hydrogen, in a corner. This in itself invalidate anything. If he had a dream, or if he had a concept, how can he write a hexagon with hydrogen in it? Because he is the originator of the valence theory of writing appropriate structural formulas. So another ambiguity. And people say, well, he wrote a hexagon. No way. He wrote a hexagon. But no idea in system. I mean, it's clear as anything. In a corner of his hexagon, he puts Wasserstoff. Oh, this is alibi. Oh, he really means that. He meant that and this, and so on and so forth. All right. I will not challenge individual alibi, both alibis. But I'm putting all this together, and I get a different kind of a composite picture of a man who was striving for priority. I am also of the opinion that Loschmidt was much closer, because he put the inner circle and puts hydrogen outside carbon atom. This is another point in the question, whether Kekulé was aware of the Loschmidt structure. And the answer is yes. He referred to Loschmidt, but referred to them as confusion formulas. And why do the doubters or people don't recognize the fact that he got it from Loschmidt? Because in his estate, in his library, they couldn't find any Loschmidt publication. Well, the fact that you couldn't find it there does not invalidate the fact that he has seen it and referred to it in other publications. This is Bader's one.
Right.
But he incidentally, talking about Bader, Bader stepped in when Bill Wismerser died. Wismerser wrote to me to support our research, and he was to speak in Boston, but he died before he could come, and I had to beg Bader to step in as a substitute for Wismerser, which he freely acknowledged.